Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Connie Boland. I'm the founder of Warbirds in Review and the coordinator. But this crew that we have inside the building, for those of you who are out front of the Quonset Hut building here this morning, we are hiding inside the building with our crew all set up here with the gentleman who will be presenting this morning. My job is to thank our sponsors, First Scott's Miracle-Gro Company, who makes this presentation possible, and to Ron and Diane Fagan, especially this morning where we have a nice green room where we normally brief and then we come out in front of the crowd. But today we are inside because of the inclement weather here in Wisconsin, and the aircraft is also in a nice covered area. So unfortunately, we cannot have the airplane here, but if you'll hang with us here, we're going to have some great footage of this beautiful airplane, Thunderbird. We're going to tell you about the history of it. And again, we thank Ron and Diane Fagan for this building that allows us to present this and have you view us on the Jumbotron. Here shortly, right after the video, I will be introducing Brigadier General Ed McElhinney, who is our moderator today, and then he will introduce our guest again to feature the beautiful aircraft Thunderbird. I am very pleased to be a female aviator, or an aviator at all, actually, is what really matters, and follow in the footsteps of a lady, Jackie Cochran, who was the owner of the featured aircraft today at one point in time. I'd like to read just an opening to tell you a little bit about Jackie and the history. This opening is in her book that was published in 1987. Jackie Cochran left an indelible mark on the history of aviation. At the time of her death in 1980, she had more speed, altitude, and distance records than any other pilot, male or female, and no one has ever matched her achievement. Today, I am pleased that Warren Peach has preserved our history of Jimmy Stewart, Jackie Cochran, and the common man, but I won't steal Warren's thunder in his line here. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here, those of you who are in the audience here live at Oshkosh, and those of you watching. But if you will direct your attention now to the Jumbotron and the video, we have prepared the introduction, and then we'll get on with the program with General McElhinney introducing our guest. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ed McElhinney, and I'm going to be the rudder that steers the ship here today in this program. I apologize, first of all, for not having the aircraft behind us. Unfortunately, the weather here in Wisconsin did not cooperate, and with such a valuable aircraft as this, we decided to be somewhat conservative. You can see three gentlemen off to my left here, and what we're going to be talking about, those of you who are out on the ramp right now, you can see that sign that says History, Heritage, and Heroes. And we're going to touch on all three of those today. Quick introductions. The good news is that we'll have a little bit more time for discussion today because, we don't have the walk around. We're not going to be able to look at the aircraft, which I suspect we'll be able to sometime during the show if the weather cooperates, because it is an absolutely gorgeous aircraft. To my left, owner of the aircraft, Warren Peach. Okay. He's going to be doing most of the talking today. You saw him briefly in the slides there. Next to his left, we've got Chuck Cravens. He's our fact checker today. He's going to be the guy, if we start telling stories, he's going to wave the flag and he's going to go, no, wait a second. No, this is really how it is. So he's going to be our expert in that regard. And then the last guy's just a pilot. I'll harass Bernie a little bit, Bernie Vasquez. Probably one of the high-time warbird pilots in the world, flown a little bit of everything. And I'd have to say, most hours, has anybody else flown the Thunderbird besides yourself at this point? Only guy who's flown the Thunderbird. So he's going to talk a little bit to us about the Thunderbird and its current performance characteristics. So with that, I'll get on. And Warren, I'm going to say first, thank you for being here, and thank you for what you've done with this aircraft. It is just spectacular as far as I'm concerned. It's got a history that's that long. And you know most of it. And I'll start with a quick question. Okay, where did it come from? How did you acquire it? We know that you wanted to always fly a P-51 and own a P-51. Well, you've made it happen. Okay, and how did it? How did this particular aircraft come into your being?
Well, it started in 1999, as the video said, in search of a P-51A, because Jerry Beck at Tri-State Aviation was developing P-51A program where he was going to build 10 airplanes, and I had hoped to build the second one, and Jerry and I were on our way to Cleveland with a Corsair and a TBM, and we stopped in Oshkosh and talked to Gene Chase. We had lunch with him, and when Jerry was telling him about this, and Gene said, well, he said, I think I know where there's some paperwork for a P-51A and some wreckage, and he described the accident up in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, and he used to work for James Cook, Gene did, and so I went hunting for that, you know, eventually over the next couple of years, and found out that, in fact, his story was accurate, and that there was an airplane up there, there was some paperwork, and I found out that it wasn't an A, but you know what? Halfway down the road, let's go ahead and keep pursuing this and keep going. So it turned out to be a P-51C. And then I learned that it was, and I've always liked Jimmy Stewart. I mean, this is about restoring one of your heroes' airplanes. And his military record, his Hollywood persona, everything about him was pretty cool.
Who didn't and like it, Jimmy Stewart?
Exactly. But to be able to say that now I have his airplane that he owned was pretty cool. So the project really started in 1999, this particular project. I want to back up a number of years. My dad, Alfred Peach, built a Starduster II in 1967. And when I was 10, we followed him down to Rockford to the EAA convention. He was flying that airplane, and the family was in a Mooney. And I was in the back seat, obviously, because I was 10. And I saw P-51s for the first time, and I don't remember how many there were, half a dozen of them. And one of them had stars and bars on it, and the rest of them were civilian airplanes. And Bob Hoover flew, and I went home and painted a picture of a P-51 on my bedroom wall with an opaque projector. I'm not an artist, but anyway, I painted this, and I started dreaming. And the dream, you know, ebbed and flowed through the years, but it never did stop. And I was able to fly other people's airplanes, which was really really an honor for me, and I'm very happy with the people that helped me get into the industry. Jerry Beck, Bob Odegaard, Dr. Hank Reichert, and there's a number of them that allowed me to fly their airplanes. So it kind of came and went, and then in 2017 I sold part of our FBO, and with the intent of retiring.
Good luck.
And that uh-huh. money, and that
How'd
money,
that work out?
Well, Thunderbird is now my retirement. So anyway, that's where that airplane came from. But you know, the 10-year-old boy influenced by Experimental Aviation Association in Rockford, Illinois, before the convention moved to Oshkosh, and it just kept going and going and going. And so that's the story behind the project.
And when you found it, you said it was an airplane. Bits and pieces, parts?
Bits and pieces. It had, as it said, you know, it had crashed.
Yeah.
It was there, and there was stuff that we could work with. And we obviously, the airplane, as so many of them, I won't say obviously, but there's pieces internally in the airplane that are original North American pieces, but a lot of the structure has had to been reconstructed, which I think is true with just about any restoration that you see out there. You know,
how long a restoration process? How long did it take?
Well, we bought another project, and were able to get the wing from that project and some other parts in 2019. And so the airplane was basically structure complete. And then we moved it to Air Corps in June of 20. And that's how long it's been in, I don't know what you'd say, completion or assembly or whatever, but that's where, you know, Mark Tisler and the whole Air Corps group, excuse me, has been so beneficial for me, because they have the expertise and the talent to do the things that I certainly couldn't do.
And when was the first flight? When did you first fly this thing?
A month ago, wasn't it?
a month ago.
June 6th.
Right.
All right.
D-Day.
So it's not very long ago, and here we are.
Yep.
Well, thank you for that.
And the paint is extremely fresh. The painter, Roy Kiefer of Custom Aircraft Finishes out of Castleton, North Dakota, thank you, Roy, is here right now over in the Weeks hangar. Mm-hmm. He was detailing the airplane this morning for us because the clear was put on a week ago today.
Okay.
So when it came here, Murray and I brought it down Sunday. It came here and it was still drying, gassing off, and everybody that walked around the airplane could smell it. And so I don't know that there's going to be an article, but if there is, I think they should title it, "Did you get a whiff of that blue Mustang?"
talking about the blue Mustang, I mean, it was highly, highly polished back when it was a racer, right? Same color, basically. It's close.
Yeah.
But I mean, that thing was just gleaming. And again, for speed, right? I mean, that was why they did it.
Supposedly, was it 48 coats of paint? Of lacquer paint increased the speed by 8 miles an hour.
Wow.
And again, like you talked about, he ran short of gas, just short of Cleveland in 48. So he was doing everything they could to get that airplane to not only win the race, but to extend its range and things like that. So the finish that we put on it is not the same as they used then, because I'm interested in not repainting the airplane every year like they were doing.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, uh-huh. But it is a really, really pretty finish, and it replicates the sheen of the original airplane, I think, to a T.
Our shirts are close, okay?
They're pretty close.
Very nice shirts, too, by the way. All right, how about let's get into the history of the airplane a little bit. And you know, you talked about Jimmy Stewart. We talked about Jackie Cochran. There's story after story after story, it seems. And that's what you want to represent here with this airplane.
It absolutely is. And thanks, Ed. And again, just to back up a little, thank you for Warbirds in Review for hosting us and having us here. It's an honor to be here representing this airplane, and it's an honor to have this airplane here to represent those three stories. And for it to debut in Vintage Aviation, I apologize to Warbirds, but it was a vintage
airplane.
It was
a vintage
racer, yep. I'm kind of a vintage guy at heart, but it was, it never had a gun in it, so it never fought in the war and everything, the representation or the story that I'd like the airplane to be recognized for is not only how pretty it is and the records that it set, but the three people that flew it were representative of World War II veterans, great Americans, patriots, all. And it kind of, in my mind, starts out with Joe DiBona, who was a World War II ferry pilot veteran who had a dream of winning the Bendix race. He raced it in 47 in Magic Town. He raced in 48 in Thunderbird, and he raced in 49 in Thunderbird and won, and still holds the piston-powered record for the Bendix race. Mm-hmm. Common man achieves his dream. Jimmy Stewart, another war hero, commanded men. He was an actor before the war, enlisted. As the thing said, he was a commander of the Thunderbird squadron, B-24s. Jackson Cochran holds more records today than any other aviator in the world. She was a patriot. She started the WASP. She did all these things. I think it's important to look at the airplane and understand what's involved in there. You know, in the Queen Elizabeth II coronation films, that was a pretty neat race, too. So
that came from what, on that coronation thing, it was from Canada. They were flying the canisters down, weren't they?
No, the Pony Express was coming from Goose Bay to Boston for the two different networks. CBS is what Mr. Alex flew in, the Thunderbird airplane.
Okay.
And then Paul Mance's airplane, who they obviously had some sort of a little contest going on between Mance and DiBona and Mance's pilots, because DiBona had lost to Mance in 47 and 48, and then Mance's airplanes lost to him in 49, so they re-ran that race, and they lost again.
Chuck can kind of fill us in a little bit on that coronation thing.
Essentially kind of a publicity stunt in a way. It's television history, really, because there had never been an event televised in the United States that happened overseas on the same day. And, of course, there's no satellites, and it was...
this is 1953. Okay.
It was possible to do it with a undersea cable, except it would take up the whole cable. So economically, that wasn't feasible. So the RAF flew the what we would now call videotapes to Goose Bay and Canberra, and they also flew them on to Canada. The two Mustangs picked up their copies for their network and flew to Boston to try to be the first ones to put that on the air, the coronation, the same day. Mm-hmm. So, and it is the first time that that's happened. The other network realized that Thunderbird was going to win, so they punted and got coverage from Canada and actually got it on the air first. But Thunderbird won the race. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the airplane a little bit, and I'll go down to Bernie now for a minute. You know, points of note that, you know, from the onset, you know, I mean, you did several engine runs probably on the thing, and did it start and run perfect the first time? Or were there little things that went wrong? What do you think about that side of it all?
It went very well. There's always teething problems in a project. You never, ever start anything and get it the first time. Mm-hmm. But I will say this is the fourth airplane we picked up from Air Corps now.
Okay.
And they just keep getting better.
Good.
It was pretty effortless out of the gate. We did all the ground runs, got it all prepared. And, I mean, it was – they do a good job of
– All right.
Done quite a few test flights this year in different airplanes and for different companies, and it's impressive.
Okay. And let's talk about the first flight. Went well, no big issues. It wasn't one of these, hey, airborne, I got a problem, come right back down and land.
No, I'll do exactly what I did on the first test flight. He was behind me, said brake release. I let go of the brakes, ran the power up to takeoff power, and it broke ground. Wanted to wait just a little bit to get the gear up in case there was a problem. Elected to put the gear up and started climbing, setting a deck angle for the speed I wanted to climb at, which was about 130. And it was so impressive. I keyed the mic. All of the Air Corps guys were on a radio listening to us. I just keyed the mic and went, yee-haw. Because I've never been in a Mustang ever that performs like this airplane.
Okay.
It's light. They've taken, just like that picture showed during the Bidnick's race, they took everything out that would have been quote-unquote, a stock Mustang, which for Air Corps, guys, it was hard to build the airplane because Mark Tisser told me at one point the guys would bring this restoration package over and say, okay, all this needs to go in the airplane. And he'd look through it and take one bolt and go, no, the rest of that stuff's got to go back on the shelf. He said, well, no, it goes in the airplane. It's a racer. It's a racer. It was hard because they're so used to building everything totally authentic that it was just a funny thing to watch happen. But the airplane stripped down. It's 6,700 pounds. An H model was like right there, I think. Mm-hmm. And the H model was the biggest performance, had all the performance back then. You know, it was an interceptor made to take off and go climb. This thing does that. And it's really, really, really
impressive. It's a stock motor, right? I mean, this is
completely stock.
Okay, Glenn Wagman built the motor. So all the performance that you're getting is from a weight reduction and paint job, and so that's what's giving it the speed. You were talking about coming up here, and you know, you've again, it's unheard of, basically. You know, you got how many? What you said, 40 knots more than typical Mustang?
Yeah, 30 to 40 knots more at the same altitude. We were at 11.5. 36 inches, 2,300 RPM. Normally you'd see 220 indicated. Mm-hmm. This thing's 270. And I mean, not doing anything. It's all in trim. I mean, at one point I took my hands off and went like this, and It's just, it's that fast.
Any additional limitations because they've lightened it up as much as they have? You know, say, you know.
I'm worried when I do the air show that when I do the top of the, when I come over the top for the Cuban 8, that I'm going to be too high.
Okay. Yeah. No big deal.
No. There's they race the high backs for a reason. We fast forward 50 years. You know, when I worked quite a bit on Voodoo as a younger person on the crew, did a lot of the work modifying it, put back on the race turtle deck, which tells you right there that they took the bubbles off in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and put these little turtle decks on to get the air to flow back faster. So a high back airplane's faster anyways. Razorback P-47, a Razorback Mustang, they're just faster, you know, but you can see why they did a D model, because you can't see out of these things. You know, you're every time you turn, your head hits something. Yeah. That's just one of the limitations.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, sounds like a great flying airplane. I'll say that right now. And again, I wish we had it out here, and I look forward to walking around it myself. But Warren, more stories about the history of this airplane. You know, the Jimmy Stewart, he sold it to Jackie Cochran for what, $1, I think, is, you know, and then
won an OVC.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And did Jackie want it to set records? That was her goal.
Yeah, I think Absolutely. This was the third Mustang that she'd owned, right?
Think so.
Yeah, and raced. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and just to back up real quick to the first test flight, Ben Redman and I were behind him, and I was allowing him to get airborne and the gear up completely before I took off, because I wanted him to have their own D model Mustang.
Okay.
And in my opinion, our fastest D model Mustang at the museum, which turned out to not be quite fast enough for this particular mission, I guess. But I don't know. But anyway, the funny part was is we'd briefed it. Okay, I'm going to let you get the gear up before a go, because if something there is a problem, I want you to have all the runway to use. I don't want to be competing with you.
Yeah.
And so I'm coming around the corner while he's adding power, and I see the wheels break ground, and he goes a little ways, and like he said, pull the gear up. And I'm busy in the cockpit for a second, and Ben's saying, yeah, the gear's up and stuff, and he goes, yeehaw, and I'm looking out there about where a normal Mustang would be at this point, and I don't have him in sight. And Ben says, look at that thing go. And he says, yeehaw, and I looked up like this, and I went, wow, it's really climbing. and then the chase began.
Wow.
Yeah, but anyway, so the history on the airplane, the video seemed to carry it pretty well. I don't know if
this you've was got never your intent, though. When you bought a Mustang, you sat there, and I just want a Mustang. And then all of a sudden, you found that, hey, you've got Thunderbird.
It has met my expectations and exceeded them this whole project the whole time. And I'm so happy with the whole thing right now. I think these guys will tell you that at Texas Flying Legends, they had a nickname for me, EFD. Eternal face of disgust.
Out of everybody in this group right here, I've known them and worked with them the longest. I've never seen the mustache curl up. It's always a frown. And so people keep asking me, he must just be totally excited. I said, have you ever seen his mustache go up? And it's been like that for 20 days now. Since the first flight.
Outstanding.
I can't say that I see anything wrong with the airplane. I think the paint job is phenomenal, and the scheme. I mean, it's when you look at that up on the screen now.
Oh yeah.
That's a retro paint job. That's 1949, and them guys absolutely nailed the scheme as far as proportions and beauty and stuff. As we painted the airplane, and I vacillated. These guys will tell you I vacillated over that blue for years, and in the last 6 months, it was like every pickup, every car, everything I saw. That must be the blue, you know?
6 months? Every phone call, and we have phone calls. I live in California. He lives in North Dakota. 3 to 5 times a day, we're back and forth. And it got to the point where it would...
About the color?
Nope.
Oh.
That's just about business. Just friends calling each other.
Okay.
But every time the phone rang, I'd answer it, go, yellow and blue, yellow and blue, yellow and blue. And then Eric Hocuff randomly, as the paint job is happening, I mean, they're laying paint. Oh. Eric and his crew and the guys start looking at these black and white photos, and they go, the rudder's not blue. What do you mean the rudder's not blue? It's black. The checkered flag back then was yellow and black. Mm-hmm. They painted it, and it was a discussion internally. He called me, and I'm like, I think that's going to look horrible. But if it's the way it was, paint it. That was the biggest home run for this airplane.
Yeah.
If it was blue, it just wouldn't look finished.
And all artist renditions were blue.
Yep. It actually, it was, as Bernie said, as it was painted, and they started questioning it. And I went back. I've been collecting photographs and stuff forever with lots of cooperation from the Air Racing Historians Association. And there was the one color picture, and they blew up the rudder.
Yeah.
And then you could see it. And you can go back and look at the black and whites, and some of them look like the dark checkers are blue. Mm-hmm. And I think what probably happened is they probably were blue mm-hmm. and got painted black before the race. Mm-hmm. And that's a real common thing to have happen. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that about that color or look is so many photos, black and white photos of the airplane were available. But we couldn't see the blue from that, obviously. Yeah, yeah. But we were trying to gauge what shade blue is. Is it light blue? Is it dark blue? Whatever it is, because some of them were gray and some of them, look at that one. You know, up in there. It looks like it's dark blue, right? Yeah. Well, we found a color that changes with the light.
Yeah.
And that's what this one does. And I stood out there on the line the other night as the sun was going down in the smoke, and I just kept watching it, and it just kept getting darker. Not the light, but I mean the color just kept getting darker and darker throughout the evening, and I was like, man, it really worked. And the, you know, and then the stripe down the side, do you see the stripe around the back windows, and then it goes up over the exhaust stacks to that emblem, the Thunderbird emblem. And we really worked on that in the paint shop. Yeah. Roy and Bruce, and we kept looking at it. And if you look at it, you'll see that in the original pictures, it had a little curve to it, and we replicated that curve here, and we've kind of figured out why they did it. There's some certain pieces in the airplane that lend themselves to going around to make that mm-hmm. that curve happen. And I finally was trying to describe it to them guys. I said, I don't know what it is, but it looks like the end of a signature. Where you just kind of accelerate away from your name
and
doing something, you know. But it's a neat look, and hats off to the guys that painted it into Air Corps for the stencils. But that little emblem that's up in the front of there, that Thunderbird, is all painted. It's all masked and painted, and it took a day and a half for Bruce to do that. He'd lay down a mask, paint a color, peel that off, lay down another one, peel out the next color. Yeah. And the Pegasus horse is the same way, you know. So all the trim you see on that airplane is all painted.
Talk
trim.
A little bit about the Pegasus horse. You know, I saw it on my shirt. I'm kind of going, and you said, oh, that's a, it's a. Go ahead, Chuck.
It's a trademark symbol for Mobil Oil.
Okay.
And sign collectors. That's a sign that's really sought after. You know, they used to have big ones on gas stations, but it's a pretty, pretty identifiable logo, and
very
they created some special gasoline, 150 octane, to increase the horsepower. I've read, and I don't know this for a fact, but I've read they were getting 3,000 horsepower out of it for the race.
Did they provided the gasoline for the race? Okay, and who? Somebody had the story about they ran out of gas 53 miles short at the one time. And it's, obviously, we want to get as much gas in that thing as possible. And tell me the story about the dry ice.
Well, there's a picture, and I didn't provide it to these guys, but there's a picture of it at Rosamond Lake Bed of an old gas truck. Obviously, it was new then. And there's canisters that they're lowering into the top of the truck that are full of dry ice. And the airplane had a wet wing. Mm-hmm. And so they had covers off of the out in the tips and at the leading edge of the wing, and they're putting that cold gas, which we all know shrinks, into the airplane, and then putting the covers on and putting them shut so they could launch right away and mm-hmm. climb into cold air mm-hmm. and keep the gas from expanding. And it kind of gives you an idea how single-minded Joe DiBona must have been about, you know, I ran out last time. I'm not doing it again.
It's extreme. I mean, this is you're taking it to the extreme here, and as much gas as you can get in there. It's very interesting.
But it's a cool idea.
Yeah, well, I agree.
They had the wherewithal to do it, and there weren't any regs keeping them from doing it. So one of the other things, and I don't, did you have more
keep
stuff
going. Yet? I got more questions.
So if they could go back to that picture that showed the anvil.
The anvil, yeah, I'd say.
It's like the most asked question. With the least amount of answers. Yeah. But I have a couple of theories on there. And the 1853 anvil that's below the left side rear window, when you look at the airplane, there was a 1853 anvil chorus. And one of the guys at Air Corps, found this and said, you know, it was written for an opera. And Glenn Miller did a swing tune of that 1853 opera. And Glenn Miller and Jimmy Stewart were friends. Glenn Miller died during the war.
Yeah.
Jimmy Stewart played him in a movie, The Glenn Miller Story, after the war. So I think that might have been, you know,
a tribute of sorts.
Yeah, acknowledgement, a tribute, and the lyrics in the opera, to me, kind of say what Jimmy Stewart was thinking. Because when you read the book Mission, in there, Jimmy Stewart was PTSD. Mm-hmm. We didn't have that word, but he was traumatized by that war. Yeah. He kept his men's morale up. He was a great leader. But he was obviously really affected by the weight that he carried as a leader during that war. And he was tired of killing people and seeing his friends get killed. And he associated that, he associated with airplanes with that. And there's a paragraph in the book that says there was a day where he said, I'm never going to fly again. Mm-hmm. He told somebody that. Mm-hmm. I think he came out of the war. He was a pilot before the war. He loved aviation. He started the Thunderbird Airfield in Arizona, you know, with some other actors and stuff. This airplane, I think, was something that made him happy. Mm-hmm. He could associate happiness with airplanes. And so the lyrics in that opera were basically gypsy maiden, it's time to quit mourning, it's time to celebrate, take off your dark clothes, mm-hmm. put on bright colored clothes and stuff. So there was that. Mm-hmm. The second theory I have on the anvil is his grandfather started their family hardware store in Indiana, Pennsylvania in 1853. And the anvil in the mid-1800s was the emblem for a blacksmith shop. Mm-hmm. And I think a blacksmith shop and a hardware store were pretty much the same thing. Yeah. You know, so I don't know. There's a romantic version and there's a simple family recognition version there. But now I don't have to tell that story to anybody anymore because it just kept happening over and over and over.
We were going to put a sign out by the airplane. The anvil will be told every half hour on the hour because it seriously is. Yeah. You know, we're sitting around the airplane and, hey, excuse me, do you know what's the anvil? To go talk to the guy in the yellow hat.
It seems like so many symbols on the airplane have dual meanings.
I really like that because that's the way I think. Yeah. I look at something and I go, well, that's synonymous with this, but it
also applies
to this.
If we were
going to
do it the way you think, we'd have like 40,000 emblems on it. EFD.
Mm-hmm. How about the future? Where's it going? What's it going to do? You going to fly it some more?
It's going to go back to California. Okay. It's going to live in my hangar, and I'm trading him a North American Navy on, so he still has a North American.
Nice try, Bernie.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to work, but I want to.
The Navion's brightly painted. At least it's got to go. It's going to live in the Dakota Territory Air Museum, and it'll get campaigned around the country, and people will get a chance to see it. Yeah, it's really nice right now, and I'd love to keep it that way, but I'm not gonna make it a hangar queen.
You're gonna fly it.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Good.
And so, that's what I see the future of the airplane, and I'll fly it for however many years. I'm not gonna put a limit on it, and when that's over, I'll look for a new caretaker for the airplane to keep it going.
Go ahead, Bernie.
I'll be the caretaker.
You're volunteering, is what you're saying. Yeah. And to go way back, this airframe never flew in combat. This was not a warplane per se.
It was being delivered from Dallas with 11 other airplanes. So there was 12 airplanes, I think, total. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but to be shipped to the Pacific Theater, China, Burma, India, whatever, and had a landing accident in Palm Springs and was abandoned there until after the war. And I'm thinking that Jimmy Stewart had some pull with the DOD and some different people, and so they ended up with this airplane, and its
original airworthiness was as a
Exactly. It was built in 1948 and assigned a serial number. So
And it's not
it was an air racer.
It's not a serial number that has anything to do with a North American or Army Air Force serial numbers. It doesn't make sense for either of those.
That Palm Springs airplane is that number is in that serial number, and they dropped a couple numbers at the beginning of it. And that's what I think happened, and it would only make sense. Why would you build a Mustang when there was all of those airplanes available after the war?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you take
they
one?
They just went and picked one and said, we're going to strip it.
Yeah.
And it's what's funny is the airplanes have several different serial numbers, and so they're easily confused.
Yeah.
And that airplane, you know, that's why the whole story about it going down to vintage is it really never was what we know as a warbird.
Sure.
It never made it to the war.
Yeah.
It never left U.S. soil.
Yep.
It got built in its civilian world for one purpose. Mm-hmm. They wanted to go do the Bendix.
Yeah.
And then they did it, and it had its unfortunate accident. He finds the pieces, links it all together, builds it. I mean, he originally wanted an A, builds this thing back to what it was, and now we're here with it trying to display. And what's cool about this airplane is he brought it up before with the common man, the war hero, the records it set.
Yeah.
And when you look at it now, we're repeating the history again.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing. It's
owner pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Girl.
Yeah. and trophy. We can't forget the trophy there too.
This is a replica of the Bendix trophy that would have been given to the pilots
the whole
that
time
won.
You just put that in the dryer and it shrank.
Yeah. the actual traveling Bendix trophy was never given to a winner, and it's on display at the Wright-Patterson Museum. And so, and it has the plaques on it of each year's winners on there. But this is a bronze replica of the trophy that Joe DiBona would have taken home with him.
How many years, Chuck? Okay, this is a question. How many years did they have the air races? Any idea?
The Bendix was connected to the Cleveland air races.
Right.
And I believe that began in the early 20s. Mm-hmm. The 49 race was, there was a tragic event, and it ended the Cleveland air races, and that was what the Bendix flew from L.A. to Cleveland. The Mustang Beguine, they lost control, crashed into a house, and killed two people, a mother and their child, and so that was kind of the end of the Cleveland air races. Mm-hmm. They did run the Bendix, but really from 49 on, it was kind of a military jet race. Like Warren said, there was no more. It wasn't run with piston engines again. So,
This airplane won the last Bendix race.
Correct.
The last piston-powered Bendix race, and that's why the record still stands.
Yeah.
Yep.
It also set a transcontinental record, and you know the speeds are a little unbelievable until people consider that those are across the ground speeds with hellacious tailwinds, because the transcontinental record is 560 miles an hour, and you know you're not going to fly that Mustang at 560 miles an hour at sea level in still air. So
now the Cleveland race, I read the other day, they said that the tailwind averaged between 8 and 18 miles an hour, so it was mostly Mustang at altitude that was doing that.
Yeah. And if you look at the picture, they're running the course at Reno with way more hopped up engines, asking way more out of it. I mean, these guys essentially had stock engines.
Yeah.
They had 150 fuel from Mobil, which we get ours from, I can't even think of it right now, but we get high octane fuel for Reno, but it's 50 years later and we're not going any faster.
Yeah.
Granted, we're on a close course, a round course.
And down low.
Yeah.
So the true airspeeds aren't there.
Yeah.
They could be the like when you look at some of the pictures of the airplane taxiing in at Cleveland, there's a black streak all the way to the rudder post and the tongue's hanging out on that thing. So you know he never came off the stop in that race. It went to altitude and stayed there the whole time.
How old was he when he won the race? Any idea, Joe?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
He appears to be in his 40s in the pictures.
Okay.
Yeah. And it went, well, maybe late 30s, because, I mean, he was in the military in the war.
Yep.
He was probably only 25. The war might have aged
him. So it aged a lot of people.
All right. I have a question about the questions. Are we going to have an opportunity to do questions? We are. There are some folks out there that we can, I'll open it up. And I think we're going to try to stay in here. I think that's the best. But if there are questions out there, I think we've got a microphone that can be passed around. And I see Bruce out there. I think that's Bruce. Okay. And we've got a question. So let's let the questions roll.
Where would the airplane be displayed for the rest of the event here at Oshkosh?
All right. Hard to hear. Let's see.
Where will the airplane be displayed for the rest of the convention?
Where will it be displayed for the rest of the convention?
Warbirds, right down here at the end of the pavement.
Okay.
Down where they see that pylon that's set up behind the Barnstormers apparel.
Okay.
So the airplane will be right in front of that.
Okay. So it'll be there when the weather cooperates. We'll leave it at that. Anybody else? Any other questions out there?
Gentlemen, thanks for a great presentation. Did Jimmy Stewart actually fly Thunderbird?
Not that we're aware of.
Well, actually, that's not true.
Really?
I have that Western Guns article that the kid's dad was an actor, Western actor with Jimmy Stewart, and he talks about his dad had an air coupe and took him out to the airport one day to have a meeting with Jimmy Stewart, and Jimmy Stewart taxied in a blue Mustang.
Really?
Yeah.
Here we go.
I haven't seen that article.
I've been looking. All right.
One up on Warren.
He's the fact checker now.
All right. I didn't know that one for sure.
The airplane appears to have a D model wing on it. Can you tell me why?
A D model wing.
Yep, I can. When the airplane originally had a problem with James Cook, it was because the gear was trapped in C models, and Bernie, correct me if I'm wrong, but C model wings were inferior to D model wings, and the fact that they only had one uplock on the clam doors, and I think it was at the back of the clam doors, and they had a little bit of history about at speed the doors coming open and the gear coming out and a wing coming off the airplane or something
that. In the early stages of P-51 existence, they originally didn't have uplocks on the clam doors, and they had a couple instances where the gear didn't make the actual uplock, and under G, the gear came out. So then they modified them, and they put uplocks on the clam doors to fix that, but sometimes those were problematic on the early airplanes, and so this particular airplane ended up with one main gear out, the tailwheel out, one main gear hung. The guy must have been a little inexperienced or probably just didn't care because there was 1,000 of them out there. So he elected to climb to altitude and jump out. Any of us would have put the gear up and bellied it in. It would have done a lot less damage.
And I knew that Bernie was going to be flying at an air show, so I wanted the best possible wing, strongest wing we could put on it.
So to answer the question and make a long story really short, it's got a D-wing because the landing gear system is better, in our opinion. There's going to be 1,000 people that argue it.
Well, and there's
1,000 different ways to skin something. This is just what he chose to do.
North American chose to improve the gear system, and I would rather be that way. And they actually built a C-model with a D-wing on it, and they tested that airplane. And in the process of putting the bubble on top of the airplane, I'm sure they elected, well, let's just keep the BC production line going, and we're going to transfer over here to that and live with what we've got. But that's the reason for the D-wing. And actually, I haven't flown it, but I kind of think the D-wing with the combination of the C fuselage is is maybe a little faster than a C, and it's a little better approach speeds. It's because of the extra canted leading edge on it and stuff.
Do you put a brand new aluminum big block in your Chevy?
Yeah,
because it's better.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's the answer for the DUA.
You know, we kind of got a local expert here about landing Mustangs with only a tailwheel and one. Yeah, I think Connie, didn't you have that problem?
Yeah. Yeah, but Warren wants to
check YouTube and you may
find
them.
We want to know now.